The interviews. McDonald Duck was stressed, thought he. It's such a bummer. How could a pro like me be second bested by a drummer? But when the pressure of the takeoff blast had passed, and Sam recalled the interviewing task Rip had suggested, he got his bearings back and felt revitalized and rested. The first he wished to interview was Stephen Clift of Continental Plate and Drift. McDonald Duck was sure that if the man had located some diamonds or some ore, his company would find a way to get back up to Crow and Drill, no matter whom they had to kill, and then their stock would head uphill. But alas, though Sam used all his duckish charm and journalistic skill to feign disinterest, angle in, and ask his question, all he got was Steve Cliff's rude suggestion as to where the duck could stick his bill. Thought Sam, oh well, when insiders won't play along, by now I know the drill. I'll sell off every share, and next time that I'm on the air, I'll drop a hint that Continental Plate found not one glint of ore on Crow. And when their stock can't take the blow and crashes, what the heck, I'll buy 5,000 shares on spec. Examining the other faces in the room, the duck could see that it would be a waste of time approaching either Battle or Ben Carter, whose expressions were a glower. Sam already knew what those two thought about the mission, and that they might prefer to talk about, or better yet devour, tasty canard à l'orange, or duck in sweet and sour. Mike Jones, the white, was also looking dour. He'd nearly finished up the trip, was on the brink of fame, could almost see the ticker tape and hear the crowd shout out his name. So why, asked Sam, looked he so grim? Because, Mike growled, there was that shadow stalking him. A blacker Mike, so well connected, he could instantly reverse a poll and get himself elected. But, Sam, I've learned a lot from you. If I can raise sufficient bucks, buy time on television, manipulate the voters' minds and cause division with my lies, I'll have a chance with either slogan, I like whites or he likes guys. Said Sam, Mike Jones, I like your pluck. Your polarizing views will grab the media's attention. But play it cool. Don't push your luck by seeking votes from large minorities or mention. Sam glanced around for someone else to interview and noticed Jack Perrone sitting all alone sketching on a pad. He looked so sad, McDonald Duck was keen to know exactly what was on his mind. Why, nothing special, answered Jack. I've been assigned to draw a map of Crow. But when he showed the map to Sam, the duck was taken utterly aback. Said he, you've drawn these spheres completely black. Not so, said Jack. If you enlarge these circles to the size of Crow, you'll see a grid which demarcates a billion fenced-off lots. Each square is then a tiny plot on which one teddy bear could squat. This represents a real breakthrough for me, who stupidly had hoped one day to wield a huge eraser and rub away the lines and other demarcations separating plots of land that men call mine or nations. But when I learned I'd never more embrace her, and he dissolved in tears. Sam took another look at Jack's strange hemispheres, thought he, the fellow's lost it. He must imagine half the Crotians would agree to live on oceans, for that's how he's crisscrossed it. Then asked the duck, just who assigned this task to you? Why, I did, sobbing Jack replied. Cartographers don't work on spec. We have our pride. Heh, said Sam. I guess I'll go and interview the CEO. Then wishing Perrone lots of luck, away Sam snuck on tippy-toe, as quietly as one could go, on webbed feet, shod with thick Velcro. But finding Rob deep in a huddle with Bill James and Tessie Rubble, Sam walked across to talk to Bunter. Hey, Ned, he said, how goes it with our microbe hunter? You wouldn't want to know, said Ned. If crows wore clothes, I would have made a killing. And yet, I must admit, my efforts in genetics weren't completely unfulfilling. The DNA did positively show that roughly 3 millennia ago some Hebrews fooled around on Crow. Sam, you recall the rabbi's notion she'd repatriate each Crotian having Jewish genes? Well, then she ran into a glitch that sabotaged her noble vision. She looked at several thousand crows and saw no place for circumcision. Shrugged he, what could I say? It's something of a mystery, for just between you, Sam, and me, I've never seen one on the John and have no inkling how they pee, much less how Croesians get it on. I only know if she'd stood firm in her intention, she might have moved to Tel Aviv 500 million, plus the mention. Did any of them want to go? I think one did. His name was Mo. It's possible he changed his mind. In any case, they all got left behind. But now I find those ancient Jews did not only infuse the Croatian locals with their seed, they may have left behind some clues on how they managed to achieve their interglobal cruise. Indeed, Tom Beals's ancient books reveal what happened on the planet 30 centuries ago. Hey, that's a major scoop, cried Sam. I'll interview Tom Beal right now. No, no, said Ned. Hold off a bit on him and Schwister. I just passed by the reading nook when Beal, our crook, laid down his book, gave Becky an unfathomable look, then took her in his arms and kissed her. When Dr. Fink saw Sam approach, he smiled most cordially. McDonald Duck, forgive me that I beat you to the pot. That said, I bet you felt some dread abandoning your grassy plot. Said Sam, my cornfield's history. Last night, marauding insects ate the roots and shoots and left their trace on sand and rock. Then he went on, so, Doc, aside from visiting the John, how did it go? Said Fink, well, Sam, my theory that the Croatian ego crashed some 30 centuries ago is still in doubt, although I think the revelations of Tom Beal, which he says he will soon unseal, may lay that matter finally to rest. As for my other quest, before the crocs swam on their way, Lash told me that my favorite show, The World's Worst Alligator Races, is but fakery and stunts. Hearing this, I felt like such a dunce I swore I'd never watch the tube again. But what the hell? I learned on Crow that some men get along quite well without that TV high. And one day, using yoga, zen, or medication, so might I. Now, would a space trip also help my nutty clientele? Perhaps to some degree, but I'd prefer to see on Crow those litigation lawyers that my clientele unleashed on me. I'd have them live on mana that they'd chip from off the rocks, and when they're late to Croatian courts, have Croatian enzymes clean their clocks. McDonald Duck, had I been born a waterfowl, a wild and willful goose, I'd fly about and loose my poop on every lawyer's lawn and roof. And when they sued me, needing proof to back their words, they'd have to plead before the judge with briefcases stuffed full of turds. Said Sam, some say that shrinks are nuts, but I have never heard a human speak so cogently the wisdom of the birds. Stalker, Wright, and Blacker Mike were sitting all together when McDonald Duck came over. Said Sam a little sheepishly, I guess you know the drill. To which Mike Jones replied, hey man, we bear you no ill will. You've got your job to do, and we've got lots to say, so open up your bill and interview away. The duck then turned to Terry Wright. Said Sam, you've now spent 21 years to the day outside that smoky womb, and since you aren't interred in any tomb, and obviously haven't died, can we assume you found a better world on Crow? A better one, the poet sighed. And then he answered with a smile. A mention gave me some advice. He had no name and no profession either. He said to me, if there be rich, there must be poor, and poor is something we abhor, so we have neither. I think, continued Ter, when we draw boundaries, compare, and carry through the universe judgmental and divisive words like better and like worse, or rich and poor, or when we speak of good and bad, or straight and gay, eventually we lose our way and know not what we seek. And what is that? Asked Sam. Why, love, of course, said Terry Wright. When we find love, as I have done, to paraphrase Walt Whitman's line, the prize we really sought is won. As Terry spoke, Sam felt a lump choke up his throat and something wet invade his eye. To stall for time, he blindly jotted down a note. But when he blinked away his tears and looked at what it said, he was amazed to find the jotting read, a duck that's raised for food must never fall in love. And suddenly Sam absolutely knew the only ducks that can and do are those that fly high up above, are wild and free, and not, Sam told himself, domesticated fowl like me. My brothers, sisters, dad, and mom were axed and plucked before my eyes. Why, heck, I hardly knew my mother's peck. Can fear of losing one I've wooed be why I never loved a duck or raised a brood, and am instead obsessed by fame and fortune, power and fine food? There has to be a link. Tonight I'll mention my epiphany to Dr. Fink. He'll know what to conclude. Then suddenly Sam struck his brow in disbelief and dumb despair. Had he been blind or lost his mind? The truth had always been right there in that so ancient barnyard rule. Duck, love no duck, unless thou wouldst be fortune's fool. When Sam had wiped away his tears and felt more self-composed, he turned to Blacker Mike and said, "The whiter competition fears that with your Navajo connection you'll ace the polls and win election." "Hey, man," laughed Mike, "his campaign's cool. So far he's followed every rule. He's done part one, the trip to space, so voters know his name and face, and now if he'd just vegetate awaiting that November date, not give you fellows of the Fourth Estate the chance to crucify his ass for, say, confusing Malta with the Khyber Pass, or hound him for some carnal sin. Who knows, the sucker just might win. That said, do I believe my buddy, Rab, will help me in my quest to be a 2-year guest at that rotunda on the hill? Why, yes, I think he will." At this upspoke the Navajo. Said he, "The question is, could I create the same effect on Earth as earlier I did on Crow? I'm not so sure. For even though the promises of jobs and riches flowing from the whiter Jones would sound familiar, like those pitches to the crows, and even with you, Sam, each evening on the TV screen, quacking lines you read off electronic monitors behind the scene, lines written, by the way, by corporations backing that political machine that backs the General and Carter, corporations chaired by men so greedy to increase their power and their bottom lines, that even Billy James would blush and fall into confusion, seeing pragmatism carried to its logical conclusion. And even though our Blacker Mike would take the side of cleaner air and earth and water, good education and equality for every race and creed, and I, supporting him, would beat my drum to save our earth for those there now and those to come, as I have done to save the Crotian world from human greed, the only difference that I see in what will happen down on earth from what has happened up on Crow, is that not 5% will heed the drumbeats of a Navajo." Responded Sam, "I don't know where the two of you picked up your cynical and jaundiced views. They surely didn't come from watching TV nightly news. Mine is a proud profession, and our viewers are not dupes. When CBA occasionally stoops to pander to the bloodthirst of the mob, admittedly, a journalist must play along or lose his job, and thus his pay, which in my case is $30,000 a day. But may I say, an anchor duck like me still tries to balance fantasies arising from his errant greed with ordinary social need. And, despite what you two guys insinuate, will listen quite objectively to any Jones v. Jones debate." Bill James and Tess, who had been talking hard and fast about a subject that was anybody's guess, as Sam approached, were talking less. Said he, "Hey, Tess and Bill, for just a moment there I thought you'd given us the slip and were about to miss the ship. Did the riot of the Crotians alter any of your notions about real estate development on Crow?" "Not very likely," Tess replied. "Sam, once you get to know them, Crows are sweethearts deep inside and full of hugs. The only problem was the bugs. But then I bought some pesticide from Arnie Robb, which, with God's help, should do the job." Said Sam, "But how do you propose to get permission from the crows to spread the poison on their land?" Laughed Tess, "You mean that awful sand? Oh, we were sure they wouldn't mind. And since we didn't want to leave behind that leaky drum, Bill James and I sent all that goo direct to where the bugs by day abound. We poured it down that old abandoned transportation system underground and threw the drum in, too. It ought real quick to rid the place of all the things that creep and crawl and leave a whitish trace on rocks, and also finish off those crocs." "I see," said Sam, who felt another tear well up into his eye. How come today his tears were coming one by one on dry? And since some tears had launched him in his fabulous career, did these tears mean the end was near? Sam turned his head to see if anyone had overheard what Tess had said, but not another in the room seemed suddenly beset by gloom. Was this a scoop? And if it was, how come he wished to keep it mum from all the others in the group? "So, guys, you did that just before we blasted off?" "That's right," said Bill. "We figure in a year or so, when Tess and I return to Crow to do the building that we've planned, there shouldn't be a bug alive the length and breadth of Croatian land." Just then a member of the crew arrived to say that lunch was on the way and that the special of the day was lobster stew. So Tess stood up and took Bill's arm as lovingly as bride takes groom, and all the others rose as one and headed for the dining room.